We are in Kesel HaOser, just a couple of days before Yom Kippur. And once again, I thought, as our halachic offering for the pre-moed, no better than to refer to one of the leading halachic voices generally today, and certainly in the matters relating to Corona. Some halachic questions that came up with regards to Yom Kippur and the coronavirus. I will preface by saying, and although many people preface by saying this, that I do not intend for this to be a practical halachic ruling. Sometimes halachic people say this, and there's a question as to whether they really mean it. I definitely mean it, because this is a parshanut shir, and of course in matters as sensitive as this, everyone takes eitzah and takes a guidance from their posek, from their rabbi. But it relates to the question of how the coronavirus affects the fast on Yom Kippur. And another reason why I think it's important to offer that disclaimer is because the responsa that we will be referring to and quoting from was said in what you could call the first wave of corona, which is this time last year. And this time last year, it did look, without in any way meaning to belittle or diminish the significance or gravity of the situation, also as it is today, but this is before people were vaccinated, and therefore for a person to have corona, he was almost without defense, naturally speaking. Either way, the breakdown with regards to this matter, as set forth by Rav Osher Weiss, is essentially to divide into three categories. The firstly, those who are seriously ill with corona. Secondly, those who have symptoms, and many people were affected with symptoms of corona, and it affected them significantly. They were bedridden, v'chule, but would not necessarily feel that they were deadly ill. And finally, those who are either have tested positive but have no symptoms, asymptomatic, what's called, or those who are in bidud, who are in quarantine because who knows. For all of those who were told to go into quarantine or felt that they themselves should be there. So these are the three groups, the very seriously ill, those that have been significantly impacted by symptoms, and those that have no symptoms at all. So not surprisingly, with regards to the first category, someone who is very seriously ill, this is no different than any serious life-threatening illness, if it's in that to that degree, and therefore for a person like that, the Alenu says of Osher Weiss, they should eat and drink whatever they need. Because although there is a concept of shiurim, and shiurim, of course, are less than those measures, and everyone knows the measures and the amount of time that one waits in between eating shiurim, that's for people who are being careful to avoid becoming deadly ill. But those who already are in such a serious situation, there's no concept of shiurim with them. They eat and drink whatever they need. So category one, lo aleinu, if someone is seriously ill, so then for them they eat and drink like any other illness of that severity. Category two, which is those that have symptoms, and the symptoms, as we know, shortness of breath and high temperature and so on and so forth. So Rav Osher Weiss recommends that they, because they're not yet and hopefully won't be seriously ill, they're significantly ill, they should try with shiurim if possible. And if that doesn't work, so then they eat and drink what they need. So the recommendation of shiurim is for those in the middle category. They have symptoms, but they're optimistic that they'll get out of it. But what about the third group? The third group are those who have tested positive but have no symptoms at all. They feel fine. Or those who are in bidud. And the only reason people in bidud don't feel fine is because they're in bidud. But health-wise, they feel fine. For those people, says Osher Weiss, there is no reason at all for them not to fast. And I'd like to expand, as he does, on the final point, for those who have no symptoms or are just, quote-unquote, in bidud. Because although it sounds very straightforward, they're not sick at all. So what is it a chiddush to say that they should fast? Possibly, yes. And the reason why is because this is now set against a famous episode or series of episodes that took place in the 1800s and was the subject of a dispute among the poskim with regards to the cholera illness. And there were outbreaks, famous outbreaks of cholera, two or three times in the 1800s, 1831, 1867, and one after that as well. So Gedolei Olam, the great poskim of the 1800s, they were weighing in on this question. Needless to say, those who had contracted the illness were permitted to eat and drink whatever they needed. It was a very serious and could be life-threatening illness. But what about those who were not sick at all? There were those who said that, who contended that everyone, no one should fast during the cholera outbreak, even people who were completely healthy. And the reasoning behind it was that whoever fasts, even if they're well, it can weaken them somewhat. And the feeling for some poskim was that could make them susceptible to then contracting the illness. And therefore, there were those who said that no one should fast. Now, probably the most famous person who was matir this question was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, again in the 1800s, and he was in Vilna. And he did not occupy, as far as I know, an official rabbinic post in Vilna. And Vilna had a bezdin, and he wasn't on the bezdin. He was there to introduce the Musar system, and because he was such a gon, he went to the lion's den of the intellectual elite, which is Vilna in Lithuania, and to conquer it from within. And he would offer shiurim. He was a world-class gon, so that people should know that the Musar that he is advocating is a serious business. In fact, I'm mindful, this is going back a number of years, but my father, Zatzal, once told me that his Rosh Hashiva, Reb Leib Lapyon, one of the two Rosh Hashivas in Gateshead, Reb Leib Lapyon once remarked to them that the 1800s or the late 1800s had three outstanding gedolim, like the top three of that time. If you can stand the suspense. They were the Beis HaLevi, Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, Maral Diskin, Rabbi Yosher Ber Diskin, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. That was the information that was offered to the Bochrim by Rabbi Leib Lapyon. So my father said, you know, pardon me?
That's
so I guess maybe in Halacha, it's an interesting shayla. Maybe in the literature world, I'm not sure. So my father said, you know, having narrowed it down to three, they had to press the point, in other words. And who was the greatest of those three? So they asked Rabbi Leib Lapyon, and he said Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the greatest out of all of them in Limud. And we have very little from him in terms of Talmudic discourse, but he was the greatest of the greats. And he is famous for having issued a heter during one of the cholera outbreaks. And here, as can sometimes happen, there's more than one version of what exactly he did. Some say, and this is based on evidence from an interview with his son, it's recorded in the Sefer Tanuas HaMusar, that he allowed, again, the issue is not with sick people who were allowed to were not allowed to fast, but with people who are healthy. And to them, according to his son, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said that they should eat shiurim. Okay, in other words, they should be restricted to those amounts, not to fast, but they should take the regimen of shiurim, which is a limited heter. And some even say that Rabbi Yisrael himself did not partake of this heter personally, but that's the heter that he issued. Others, however, because another place where this is mentioned is in the famous autobiography of the Torah Tamima, Baruch Halevi Epstein, which is called Makor Baruch. And in the course of his autobiography, he basically talks about everything, it seems, that happened anywhere during his lifetime, including this episode. And the way he records it, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter actually made kiddush in front of everyone on Yom Kippur, just that no one should say, oh, maybe I'll be like Rabbi Sol Salanter and I'll fast. So that was, as you can appreciate, in a different Gersoas, but the bottom line is, he was matir. He was not the first person to be matir, healthy people during a cholera outbreak, not to fast. It goes back earlier, a generation earlier, because this was the subject of a machlokas between the Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Kiva Eger. Again, in the early 1800s, it doesn't get greater than the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Kiva Eger, father-in-law and son-in-law. But they disputed this very issue. The Chasam Sofer, again, with Shiurim, said that even healthy people should eat with Shiurim. Rabbi Kiva Eger said no, they should, if they're healthy, they should fast. He was much more emphasizing the fact that they shouldn't be so close together, which is something else that we've become very familiar with. But we see that even prior to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, it was already debated, two sides to the question, by the great poskim. Rabbi Kiva Eger said healthy people should fast. Chasam Sofer said no, they should eat shiurim. But it became very famous through Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, especially as he did not actually consult the Beis Din before issuing this ruling, and that became a point of contention. As far as he's concerned, it won't make a difference if he consults with them. They'll either agree with him, in which case he'll go ahead, or they'll disagree with him, in which case he'll still go ahead. Because he felt it's pikuach nefesh, he wasn't moved by whether or not they would agree with him. But it was considered to be quite a breach of protocol, and in fact he was summoned to a hearing the day after Yom Kippur, or a few days after Yom Kippur, to the Beis Din, almost like a disciplinary hearing to upbraid him for having done that. But he explained his reasoning, although that was one of the reasons why he actually moved away from Vilna shortly after that. So there's a lot of history around this question, but again, just to summarize the issue itself, the question is whether people who are healthy, should they fast as well or not? And that was a machlokus with regards to the cholera epidemic. However, says R' Usher Weiss, in explaining his ruling that someone who is healthy should fast, he says that whole episode does not relate to our question. And the very simple reason is that the cholera illness and the coronavirus are very different and they affect different parts of the person. In other words, cholera affects the digestive part of the person, and when it happens, so that leads to chronic dehydration and malnutrition and all of those things. So eating and drinking arms a person against that condition. There's room to say, even if he's healthy, he doesn't mean he'd be susceptible. However, all things being equal, says Rashi Weiss, if a person feels fine, even if they're positive, but they feel fine, so they need to keep an eye on themselves. But whether they eat or drink doesn't affect their respiratory system. And therefore, barring any symptoms, he's very firm on that idea that they should fast. So it's very interesting to see how, at least in principle, for the discussion, something that's happened 150 years ago and would be perhaps presumed to remain there is brought back and people are discussing it. And all these things are, in fact, as we can appreciate, many things that hadn't been discussed for a long, long time became topics of discussion halachically with regards to the coronavirus. So that's with regards to just a dvar halacha. And from there, I'd like to move more, as we do, into themes of the day. There's no lack of things to talk about and to think about over Yom Kippur, but certain points that I feel are certainly worthy of our reflection. The laning for Yom Kippur morning, of course, deals with the avoda of Yom Kippur. And it comes from the beginning of Parshas Acharemos, Vayikra, Perek Tet Zayin. And Acharemos, as we know, starts with the words, Acharemos, Shnei Bnei Aaron. That's how it all begins. They died seemingly because they went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and therefore it can't happen on a regular basis, only on Yom Kippur. That seems to be the backdrop to the whole Torah's whole presentation of Avodas Yom Kippur. And so it is that the first words that we hear coming out of the Baal Kore's mouth on Yom Kippur morning refer to the death of Aaron's two sons, Acharemos Shnei Bnei Aaron. And it seems to us, or it might seem to us, that that's not really so apropos of the day. In other words, that's the parsha, that's the historical background, but we're waiting to actually find out about Yom Kippur, and that comes in Pasuk Beis, all the Karbonos, and the whole avoda of Yom Kippur. And yet, we see from the sources that actually the death of the sons of Aaron is in fact very apropos of Yom Kippur. It's very much somehow related to the day itself. Because the Zohar HaKadosh says that on Yom Kippur, when you hear the Baal Kori mention the death of Aaron's sons, so you should take a moment and mourn for them. Which is very puzzling for two reasons. Apparently, when you hear these words in Parshas Acharemos, so you hear it and you're listening to the laning. But when you hear it on Yom Kippur, there's something about what happened to Aaron's two sons that should be the cause of mourning on Yom Kippur. But the question, of course, is what? In other words, why ever they died, that's what happened. In the meanwhile, we have Yom Kippur. Never the twain shall meet, it seems. So why does the Zohar insist and really emphasizes this point that one should take a moment of reflection and note and mourn the passing of Aaron's two sons? And I think the follow-up question, which again Meforshim ask, is what does it even mean to mourn the passing of Aaron's sons? How is that a meaningful thing? As if to say we don't know them. How are we meant to develop feelings of loss for Aaron's sons specifically? So what does this mean? And many explanations have been given, and I think it's important because this really does start the laning. So what exactly is the value here? I believe, perhaps, that one could explain the matter here based on the approach of the Meshech Chochma in Parsha Shmini to the death of Nadav and Avihu. I mean, without going all the way back to Parsha Shmini and all of the events that surround it, but to get some type of context, it's without a doubt a very mysterious thing. The Torah does not specify exactly what they did. It describes it in very vague terms. They offered Eish Zara, Asher Lo Hikriv Hashem, a strange fire that Hashem didn't command. That could mean anything. And evidence that it could mean anything is that there are eight or nine different opinions in Chazal as to what exactly they did wrong, which is a symptom of the fact that the Torah didn't spell it out. And maybe there's room for all of them, but we see that the Torah didn't really put his finger exactly on what it was. But obviously it was enough to warrant them being killed. And yet accompanying this, we have the almost confounding and certainly perplexing comments of Moshe Rabbeinu to Aaron. When Aaron is obviously, his two sons have just died, and Moshe says, Hu Hashem Diber Hashem, that's what Hashem said, Bikrovaya Kadesh, I'll be sanctified through those who are near me. Val Pnei Kol HaMekaved, I'll be honored over the people. So here is Moshe, and these are the words of the Chumash themselves. This is not a matter of interpretation. Moshe himself says that Aaron's sons were close to Hashem, and he would be sanctified for them. And this was something that had almost been predicted. This is what Hashem said, Bikrovai Ekadesh. And Rashi elaborates. Moshe says to Aaron, we knew that something was going to happen to someone who was close to Hashem. I thought it would be me or you. In the end, it's them. Apparently, they're closer to Hashem than we are. So we have this tension, I would say, between, on the one hand, if they didn't do something wrong that deserved for them to be killed, they wouldn't have been killed. So that sounds like they're in the wrong. But on the other hand, Moshe describes them as people who are close to Hashem, and Hashem is sanctified through this. So it's a very complex situation. And what does it mean? And Meshech Chochma says a most profound approach to this whole situation. We know that Nadav and Avihu die on the day of the inauguration of the Mishkan, right? Vayibayom Hashmini, it's in Parsha Shmini, that was day one. They did what they did, and they were punished. What does that have to do with Yom Hashmini? What does it have to do with the inauguration of the Mishkan? The Mishnah Chachma says, this opening day of the Mishkan was potentially one of the most sensitive days in the history of the Jewish people. And the reason being that this was the day where they finally receive full, or as full as it would be, full atonement for their first national Aveira. And this is the day of rectification and of making good, again, getting back on track, post the Chet HaEgel. The Jewish people, as a people, have never done a national sin before. This is the first. And this is the time of their recovery. And it is a very delicate time. Why? Because the question of how a person relates to kapara, to atonement, can ultimately then lead into how they relate to sin in the first place. In other words, the journey of how it works is if a person does something wrong, so then he can then make it okay again and receive atonement and expiate it through tshuva, and then he can get kapara. The question is, what does the possibility of kapara tell you about the damage or the terrible nature of a sin? Here, there might be room for misunderstanding. Because if it's possible to fix it, maybe it wasn't that broken in the first place. That's the point. If you see that everything can work out and it would all be okay, then maybe it was never really not that okay. In the same way, lahavdil, but if it is to illustrate, sometimes children, they put themselves in a terrible situation and then someone scoops them out of it. And as far as they're concerned, everything's fine. They don't realize how dire things could have been and how drastic measures needed to be taken in order to make things okay again. They just see the straight line from before and after, and maybe they were always okay. They have no notion. If they walk across the street without looking, they have no notion that it's a dangerous thing. And if a car comes and it stops, so apparently that's what cars do. They stop. Or if someone comes and scoops them up, and across the road, that's what big people do. So what that means is they because they're okay in the end, they have no notion of how close they were to being not okay at the time. And the Jewish people are in danger of making the same mistake. And if they do, so then the terrible irony of the situation is that their kapara could actually lead to more sins. And it could lead, moreover, to a complete breakdown of the relationship with Torah. Because kapara basically says, even if you sin, it's okay, do a bit of tshuva, and how bad can it be anyway? I mean, all we did was tshuva and everything's okay again. They don't realize the depth to which they sunk as a result of sin, and the height to which they were raised up again through tshuva. How can this be impressed upon them? What measures can be taken that their kapara won't be abused and it will not lead to a complete dysfunctional relationship with everything that the Torah says? Because at the back of their mind will always be, we got out of the Chet HaEgel, I guess we'll never really be in trouble. So something had to happen in order to impress upon the Jewish people at this formational time that exactly what it means to do a sin, exactly how dire it is, exactly how grave it is. A sin without tshuva is a deadly serious thing. So then they'd appreciate that if they did tshuva, it's because of the power of tshuva, not because of the lightness of the sin in the first place. To this end, you have two people who are close to Hashem, Nadav and Avihu. Now, they didn't do something right. They did something wrong. And it was judged that they would deserve to be killed. But this is the full measure of Midas Hadin, certainly. But what this means is, no one left that day. The Jewish people did not leave that setting thinking sin is a small matter. Because the death of Nadab and Avihu over a relatively slight sin on a day such as this, and there were people who were beloved to Hashem, in a sense, their demise as a result of sin impressed upon the Jewish people exactly how serious a matter sin is. If you got atonement through tshuva, you now realize how powerful tshuva is. But that should never filter back to take the sin itself lightly. And from a certain point of view, one could say, to use the expression advisedly, but Nadav and Avihu were almost like a korban. In other words, their lives were given for the future of the Jewish people, that they never, as a people, abuse the concept of tshuva. They realize that as much as tshuva helps, it helps because you needed the help. And if you want to know what you would have looked like without the help, go back to Nadav and Avihu. It's a very, very powerful idea of the Meshech Chochma. And I think there's a very short distance between his discussion and just bringing us back to Yom Kippur. Because what for them, the day where they needed to reflect on all this was the day of the setting up of the Mishkan. But the day that we need to reflect upon it is Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur is the day that we get Kapara. And what we need to ensure is that we don't make the mistake that they had to die in order to make sure the Jewish people didn't make. And that's why the introduction and the lead-in of the Avodah of Yom Kippur with the death of Bnei Aaron, it's very much connected to the heart of Yom Kippur. Because if we don't take the lesson from the death of Nadav and Avihu, we might make the mistake that their death is meant to avoid. And if we don't take the things that we've done seriously enough, we won't take Tshuva seriously enough, and then we could be left in a difficult situation. And therefore, there's a great deal to learn from them, and perhaps this is why it's considered to be such an important thing to mourn for them, because we're mourning the fact that they needed to die in order to bring this idea to the Jewish people. But the only thing worse than that tragedy is for us to miss the point that they died in order to make. And that's how the leading for Yom Kippur begins. So I think this gives us a good deal of meaning with regards to Acharei Moshe Bnei Aaron. It's not just the Parsha clearing its throat, so to speak, until we get to the Avodah of Yom Kippur, but it is very much of the essence in the way that we have suggested. So as we move just now for a moment to a few moments to a matter of the Avodah itself. One of the Yom Kippur, of course, has unique features. Famous amongst them are the Shnei Seirim, the two goats, which we've discussed on previous occasions. And also, something on this day which is not unique but is performed in a unique way is the mitzvah of Ketores, of the incense, the 11 spices that come together for the incense. Now, on the one hand, that's part of the daily avodah in the morning and in the late afternoon. Quite so. But as we know, on Yom Kippur, in addition to that, another measure of Ketores was offered, and it was brought into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The two handfuls of Ketores, which are brought by the Kohen Gadol, and it's one of the few things for which he is able to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And the question that the Mefarshim, the Baalei Machshava, are discussing is, what is the meaning of this extra measure of Ketores, and how does it relate to the core theme of Yom Kippur? Well, Ketores relates to the concept of the sense of smell. And this is something which is discussed beginning with the Tanakh and certainly through Chazal, that what the sense of smell represents is the ability to arrive at an understanding, an appreciation of something beyond that which the eye can see. As if to say, lahavdil, if it helps to illustrate, sometimes you look at something and it looks okay, but then you catch a whiff of it and then you change your mind. In other words, there's only so much that you can tell visually. But what's actually going on within something, sometimes it comes out through what is represented by the sense of smell. Lahavdil, we say that something doesn't smell right. All right? And really what we mean is I can't put my finger on it because it looks okay, but I have a feeling that on a deeper level, something's not right. Or to sniff something out in that way. And the truth is, the Navi talks in this way. Because the Pasuk in Yeshaya, which describes the Mashiach, it's in Perek Yud Aleph, or Yud Beis, I think, one of the two, Yotzachot and Mikir Yishai. So it uses the expression, V'haricho b'yiras Hashem. And he will sniff people out vis-a-vis their fear of Hashem. From Reyach, V'haricho b'yiras Hashem. And the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, he will judge people based on his sense of smell. That's what the Gemara says. But what does it mean? It means this idea. In other words, he will be endowed with the ability to see beyond perhaps that which is on the surface. And that's really what's represented by chush hareach, by the sense of smell. What does this have to do with Yom Kippur? From a certain point of view, this is what Yom Kippur is. Namely, as we come before Hashem on Yom Kippur, perhaps not with that much to our credit, and perhaps also certain things to our miscredit, so we ask for kapara, but on what basis? And what's interesting is, the word kapara itself, although we translate it as atonement, but the word kapara literally means, as Rashi says in Parshas Vayishlach, means to wipe away. Lechaper means to wipe away. And what does that mean? You can wipe away something that's on the surface. You can wipe away something that hasn't become part and parcel of the thing itself. At that point, wiping away is not going to really make a difference. Really, therefore, what we call atonement, kapara as atonement, is relating to everything that we've done wrong as extrinsic to us. But what does that mean? It means that it belies our true nature. It doesn't represent our true nature. In a sense, Yom Kippur is a day of defining ourselves and aligning ourselves with something which is much better often than the things that we do. One could almost say retreating into ourselves in order to identify with how we are inside, which is much better often than the way that we act on the outside. And that is the concept itself of the Kohen Gadol entering this place which is called Lifnai V'Lifnim, inside the inside. That is to say, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the holiest place, is the innermost place. And that's true not only geographically in the Beis HaMikdash, but it's true also experientially, it's true individually, within each person. The holiest place is the innermost place. And as surely as he enters there, so in a sense, a person also needs to enter that place. But what does it mean to enter that place? It means that they need to identify with that so that their actions can be rendered then something extrinsic which can be wiped away, which is called kapara. And that is the concept of reyach, therefore. We're almost asking Hashem to sniff us out in a positive sense, as if to say, we don't look always so good. But the deeper apprehension of how we really are should carry the day. That's what should define us. There's a fascinating comment of the Medrash with regards to the brachas that Yitzchak gives to Yaakov. So Yaakov is wearing Esav's clothes, and so the pasuk, as we know, says Vayarech Hasreach HaBegodav. He smells the aroma of Yaakov, which is really Esav's clothes. But he smells it on Yaakov, and that's the prelude to giving him the brachas. Vayarach esreach begodah. And on that, the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah has a fascinating comment. Sometimes Chazal say, "Al tikri this, eli this." Right? Don't read like this. Read like this. "Al tikri begodah," says the Medrash. Don't read his clothing. "Ela bogdov, boged, his traitors." That means that at the time, according to the Medrash, as it puts it, When Yitzchak is smelling the aroma of the clothes on Yaakov, he's smelling the traitors of Yaakov. Who are the traitors of Yaakov? So the Medrash gives an example, a couple of examples. The famous one amongst them for us, the example will suffice, is someone called Yosef Mishisa. And briefly, as the Medrash describes it, when the Romans had conquered the Beis HaMikdash, they were becholzok, you know, afraid to enter the actual Beis HaMikdash. Who knows what's going to happen to them? And therefore, they ordered a Jew. They got the Jews together and ordered one of them to go inside, just to see what would happen. And they said, as an incentive, whoever goes inside can take whatever they want, keep for themselves. And the Jews, no one could bring themselves to do that, except for one person, a traitor, a boget, an opportunist, called Yosef Mishisa. And he volunteered, and he went inside, and he came out with a menorah, with a golden menorah. I mean, just thinking about it now, how one person is able to drag such a thing, but I guess he was determined, and then he took the nicest looking thing. But at that point, the Romans went back on their word, and they said, you can have anything except for that, because that looks really nice. So we'll take that. You can go back and take something else. But then Yosef Mishisa refused. He said, I can't do it. He said, I've angered my creator once. I can't do it again. So they started to offer him more and more incentives. Not interested. But then incentives turns to threats. Once he's in, once he's the one, if you don't, there'll be consequences, nothing doing. And in the end, they killed him. And he preferred to be killed rather than go in a second time. And the reason why is because having entered the Beis HaMikdash, it had an effect on him. It kindled something. It triggered something. Something resonated. And at that point, he could no longer do it again. And he chose death over going back in again. Which is fascinating for a number of reasons. Firstly, it tells us you can never know how a person will be affected, even by a brief encounter with Kedusha. One would have thought that's it. He's consigned to evil. Look at him. He was prepared to go in. Nothing will ever help him. And only he was there, and he was there committing a crime. But he was there, and it affected him. You never know how something will affect a person. And you never know when it will affect them. That's the second fascinating point. Because he was affected by his entry into the Beis HaMikdash, but not straight away. Because it didn't stop him from dragging out the menorah. So it was not an instant effect. But later on, having been in there, and they asked him to go back, he can't go back in. And he's one of the Bogdim mentioned by the Medrash. But what's the point? The point is, these are the traitors of the Jewish people, as if to say, even someone like that, who would be written off and consigned with no hope of redemption at all. But you see, there's never no hope. You never know. Something can generate a turnaround, even in a person like that. And that's called Vayarach Esreach Begadav. That's called Yitzchak getting the aroma of the bogdim, because if you look at them, you'll write them off. But if you have a deeper appreciation of what's inside of them, you never will, because you never know, as is the case of Yosef Mishisa. And therefore, this is now the on a defining level, the significance of the extra measure of Ketores that is brought lifnai v'lifnim, as if to say, that what the Ketores represents, the aroma which gives a deeper appreciation of what's inside the person, that effectively is what we're looking to do on Yom Kippur. That's where the kapara is going to come from Hashem defining us by what's beyond what meets the eye, so to speak. And that is one understanding of why the Ketores and the aroma of the Ketores plays such a central role as one of these special features of the Avodah of Yom Kippur. But there is a further point. If we could move almost from that which relates to each and every person to that which relates to the Jewish people as a whole. Because the Ketores itself, one of its prime characteristics and points of significance, is that it also relates to in a sense, the coming together of the Jewish people. So many different types of things brought together, and it's only together that they produce the effect which is called the Ketores. And in fact, famously, one of the one of the spices of the Keteres has a very pungent and even off-putting smell. It's a foul odor, the chelben or the galbanum. And if you would just have that, it would be awful. But when you put it together with everything else, not only is the negative effect neutralized, but it actually even brings out something from all of the others. That's the power of Tzibur. That's the power of the Jewish people being together. But what does this tell us? It reminds us, and it's easy to forget. I think if there's any day that we would define as a classic personal day, it's Yom Kippur. It's very easy to spend the entire day just thinking about you. And from a certain point of view, good. You shouldn't be thinking about other people. Certainly not in the Al-Khayt section, if you know what I mean. But everyone's looking to get their kapara. It can be a very self-absorbed day. And along comes the Keteres and says that in the end, the kapara comes to an entity which is called the Jewish people. And it comes to each individual significantly to the extent that they're part of that entity which is called the Jewish people. The most powerful atoning components of the Avodas Yom Kippurim are all communal. The Sa'ir Mishtaleach, right? That goat which somehow takes all the Averis away with all of the depth and all of that means. There's only one. It's not something each person brings. It's one. It's a Korban Tzibur. That kapara effect comes to the tzibur. So it comes to each person to the extent to which they feel that they're part of a tzibur. And that's an important reminder as well. We mentioned, I believe, in the past, a fascinating comment of the Meshech Chochma, in Parshas Tzav, I believe, that as we know, and the Rambam mentions it, and it's known that around these days people, they give a lot of tzedakah, right? And they do... They acts of kindness and so on and so forth. Why? So, on the face of it, it doesn't need explanation. Give tzedakah, you get kapara. Be careful who you give to, but you'll get kapara. If you're kind, you could even say, if you're kind to people, Hashem will be kind to you. I mean, you could explain it in so many ways. And along comes the Meshech Chochma and says, when you give tzedakah and when you do kindness, you're attaching yourself to the Jewish people. Right? You're giving of yourself to the Jewish people, and that connects you with them. That's how you get kapara, because kapara comes to the Jewish people, and now you're part of them, because you shared in their needs and contributed to alleviating them. It's an incredible perspective. And from this point of view, if the Keteres represents the togetherness of the Jewish people, the integration of the Jewish people, so when it's brought into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, we're presenting ourselves to Hashem as a whole, with which to receive kapara. But what's interesting is, as the Shemi Shmuel of Sokhachov points out, and this, the Gemara tells us, Nusach Sfarad, I think they say this every day in the section of the Keteres. One of the differences between the Keteres and Yom Kippur and the others is that every day it was ground finely, Bechol Yom Daka, but the special Keteres for Yom Kippur, Daka Min HaDaka. It was actually ground again. Right? The Keteres is generally ground to a certain degree, but the ones used in Kippur, it's ground again. U'machzir le'machteshes for every Yom Kippur. Kedei she'adaka min adaka. They put it back. Why? Because as the Shemi Shmuel, the more finely ground things are, the more together they become. Right? The more coarse they are, the more separate even the particles are. But the more finely ground they are, the more it really blends. Which means that if every day of the year you want to be blended into the Jewish people on Yom Kippur, you want to be doubly blended, right? You want to go through another grinding to make sure that it's daka min adaka, and that's why the special Keteres is ground even more finely to try and achieve a sense of even greater togetherness. And the question is, how does one do that? I mean, I'm here, they're everywhere, or wherever they are. And what does that mean? Of course, it means many things, and there's many answers. But I think perhaps one of the answers is that lies in the most unusual feature of this special Keteres. How much Keteres is brought in? Normally, halacha works in amounts. A kav, two kavs, whatever it is. A kazayas, a kabetza. I mean, it works in amounts, mostly. And so it is for Keteres, however many kavim there are, as it describes. And And then this special measure, which is brought into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, how much do you bring in? Meloch Hafnayim, two handfuls. Which is not as standardized as any of the others. It's not a measurement. It's two handfuls. And the Gemara discusses it, depending on the size of the hands of the Kohen, and there'll be more or less Keteres, and that's it. So why? Perhaps one may suggest the concept of Meloch Hafnayim, of two handfuls, always represents generous measure. The Rav Chisda famously says, I wash the whole hand for Netilas Shadayim, and I wash a lot, you know, with plenty of water, and as a result of that, I get Meloch Hafnayim Nachas. I get two handfuls of Nachas from heaven. Meloch Hafnayim represents generous measure. Perhaps what's behind this measure of this Ketores is that the way that one achieves Daka Menadaka, it's a faculty that we all have. It's just called generosity of spirit. That's all. We all have it. We sometimes use it sparingly. And sometimes we use the opposite with regards to people. But it's a faculty that just needs to be accessed. And certainly on a day like Yom Kippur, where it's just a question of looking benignly at everyone else. And there's so much one can say in explanation and in defense of everyone. We say about the entire Jewish people going into Yom Kippur that they're all in. It's all bishkaka. No one really means anything bad. We quote that pasuk just after Kol Nidre. Benislach lechol adas bnei Yisrael ki lechol am bishkaka. Everyone just made a mistake. It's all unintentional. I mean, that has to be the most optimistic way you can talk about the Jewish people that you can imagine. But how can it even be true? What does it mean? If it's a mistake, it's a mistake. But if it's intentional, so it's not a mistake. And some people do things wrong intentionally. So how can you call that bishkaka? How can you say l'chol ha'am bishkaka about the totality of the Jewish people? You can't normally say that, but you can on Yom Kippur. Because part of retreating, I would say, pulling back to define ourselves by what we come to identify with on this day as what we really want and what's really important, sometimes a person can make a mistake even though at the time they don't think they're making a mistake. Not every mistake is made without thinking about it at all. A person could be quite sure, this is what I want. But then they attain a bit more insight, they attain a bit more information, and they realize what I thought I wanted, I now realize I didn't, or I shouldn't have. And if you would ask me now, I wouldn't do that. So that's called shkaka. If you retreat to a point that's a more inner point, which has a greater clarity of vision, then set against that, your lower vision is mistaken. That's called shkaka. And if we're prepared to do that for ourselves, it's just one step from being prepared to do that with everyone else. And that's called Meloch Hafnayim. Look at the Jewish people. A lot of people, they've whatever they do, and whether they do it on purpose or not on purpose, but even their purpose sometimes is without purpose. And even though they're quite sure about it, but if you're from a point of view where you could say, if only they knew, and if only you could share it with them, so then maybe they'd reconsider. That's called shkaga. And then all of a sudden, there's room for everyone. It doesn't mean you need to move next door to the type of people that you don't wish to emulate. But in terms of room in your heart for the totality of the Jewish people, it starts with Meloch Hafnayim. That's how you get Daka Min HaDaka. And it's worthwhile noting, as Mefarshim point out, not only do we say that the korbanos of Yom Kippur pertain to the tzibur specifically, not to the individual, but to the tzibur specifically, but also one of the core davening pillars, which is the Yud Gimel Midas. And as we know, there's a bris, right? There's a covenant Yud Gimel Midas will never fail, right? However that works and on whatever level it's meant, but they never fail. And we use them, I would say, mercilessly and without any restraint on Yom Kippur by Ne'ilah seven times, if not more. And so on and so forth. We practically don't give our Kodesh Baruch Hu a chance. If that's what it seems like, it's like a tshuva assault. And that's what he wants. But what is the Yud Gimel Midas Hashem Hashem Karachem Machanan? What happens there? So the Gemara says it's a covenant. It's a covenant that will always take effect. And how does the Gemara describe the covenant in ways that are unbelievable? In fact, we know that it's unbelievable because that's how Rabbi Yochanan introduces it. If the Torah didn't indicate this, you could never say this. Those are Rabbi Yochanan's words. Ilmale mikra kosuv e'ef shela omro. Had the pasuk not indicated this, you would never be allowed to say this. To say what? Melamed shenis atef HaKadosh Baruch Hu kishliach tzibur. That Hashem wrapped himself up like a chazan and said, when the Jewish people are in trouble, if they've done wrong, yasu lefonai keseder hazeh. Let them invoke these Yud Gimel Midas and I'll forgive them. That's the bris, that's the covenant, where they were originally expressed by the Chet HaEgel, again, the original sin of the Jewish people, Chet HaEgel, but it remains true, that's a bris for all time. But what's fascinating is, when the Gemara says, it doesn't say that Hashem, even so to speak, that he wrapped himself in a talus and started davening. It said, Nisatef kishliach tzibur. He wrapped himself in a talus like a shliach tzibur. That indicates that the bris of the Yud Gimel Midas is a bris for the tzibur. Right? Hashem was leading the congregation, so to speak, because this applies to the congregation, but not just to any particular individual. But of course, for all of us individuals, so the congregation is made up of individuals, but only if they come together as a congregation, only if they have each other's interests at heart as well, each other's well-being at heart. And I believe it's certainly much food for thought. Again, it's very easy and for good reason to spend all of Yom Kippur in ourselves, the things that we've done. And there's worse ways to spend Yom Kippur. And there's worse things to be doing. And yet the message that comes out from all of this is, and we won't lose by it. We'll only gain by it. Because if we want the best for ourselves, we want the best for ourselves as part of the Jewish people. And ultimately, we want the best for the Jewish people themselves. And so, I wish you all a Gemar Chasim Matova. Should be a year of bracha for all the individuals, for each individual, and for the klal. We should only hear Besoros Tovos, Yeshua's Benachon.